I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Paul Katsapanis, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Boston University. We're discussing his 2016 book, The Nietzschean Self, Moral Psychology, Agency, and the Unconscious, from Oxford University Press. Katsapanis works on 19th century philosophy, especially Nietzsche, ethics, and the philosophy of action. His first book, Agency and the Foundation of Ethics, was published in 2013. Let me say, first of all, Paul, thank you for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Oh, thanks very much for having me. I'm happy to do this.
So, Paul, I found the book to be really excellent. It was a really rigorous analysis and interpretation of Nietzsche's view of human nature, both the descriptive and normative elements of his view. And you engage extremely well with the literature, which is, I think, useful for anyone out there trying to get into Nietzsche's view of human nature. It's a really good touchstone for understanding a lot of the literature out there. I think of you, classify you somewhat close to someone like John Richardson, but I think we can get into that a little bit later as far as where you distinguish yourself from his view. But I have tremendous sympathy with your view of Nietzsche, I should say, right off the bat. So first of all, thank you for writing such an excellent book.
Oh, thanks. It's very kind of you to say so. And yeah, just to anticipate, I am influenced by John Richardson, so I think you're categorizing things correctly.
Good. So first of all, I always ask my guests, what motivated you to write the book? What motivated you to write about Nietzsche in general and about his view of human nature in particular?
Yeah, good question. So I've been at work on Nietzsche for a while now. I think while I was in grad school, I got interested in some questions about the relationship between ethical claims and claims about agency. And I always found Nietzsche to be a very profitable way of thinking about those topics. He has very surprising ethical claims, so he wants to reject a lot of the ethical claims that most people accept. He's deeply critical of traditional ethical theories. He thinks that most of them are failures and so forth. But at the same time, he tries to put forth ethical claims of his own. And my reading of him is that when you look closely, I think a lot of what he wants to say about ethics is actually grounded in his account of human nature and more generally in facts about agency and so forth. So I guess when I was approaching these questions about ethics and agency, Nietzsche just seemed like a very natural and attractive source of insights into those topics. And I guess I got into him while I was in grad school. I'd taken a few courses on 19th century philosophy when I was in college and had these sort of vague memories of Nietzsche. So I went back to his books and started reading him and didn't originally intend to work on him very much, actually. But as I read more and more, I just found that there was more and more there, a lot that I wanted to say. So I guess that's how I came to him in the first place. And then why I wrote this particular book on moral psychology, I think it's actually a somewhat underexplored area of Nietzsche scholarship. So there are a lot of books on Nietzsche that will have a chapter or two on moral psychology, and there are, you know, good articles on it as well. But there wasn't any sort of full-length monograph that focuses simply on his moral psychology and tries to articulate how that should be understood and what the relation between all of these complex notions that Nietzsche introduces is. So I thought there was space for something like that in the literature and thought that it would be very interesting to try to do that.
Yeah, and his view of human nature is extremely complicated, and so it definitely deserves a detailed book, and you've given it here. So we very much appreciate it. Let's see how much of what we can tackle here in your book. Your book has 10 chapters in it. And you start with the descriptive elements, one might say, of Nietzsche's view of human nature. And you take somewhat of a building block approach, that is, that you start with some of the more basic or elemental mental phenomena and build up to the more complicated features of our mental life. So maybe we could start where you start, which is Nietzsche's view of the distinction between the unconscious and the conscious. In your chapters 2 and 3, you discuss two traditions of thinking about the unconscious, one that underlies our conscious mind and one that explains the conscious mind, and one that competes with the conscious mind. So you suggest that Nietzsche combines these different views. How does he do it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think it's important to disentangle those two conceptions of the unconscious, because I think that nowadays we just tend to associate the unconscious with elements of mental life that escape our awareness or that aren't accessible to conscious awareness. But I think in the 19th century, things were a bit more fluid, and there were these different and potentially competing ways of thinking about the unconscious. So you had some people, Nietzsche talks about Leibniz and some other people here, who attempt to explain conscious phenomena by appealing to unconscious phenomena that have a different structure. So the unconscious material is somehow processed so as to generate the conscious. And then you have other people, Helmholtz might be like this, Freud on a certain reading is like this, where the unconscious is seen as a self-contained, potentially competing system of thought that is in conflict with, at least in some cases, it's in conflict with the conscious thought. So I see Nietzsche as trying to combine those two models in a certain way. So what's interesting about Nietzsche is he definitely wants to use unconscious mental processes to explain conscious mental processes. So there, throughout his works, there's plenty of stuff on that topic. So he'll talk about how the conscious self is a product of the unconscious drives, or how our conscious thoughts are to be explained by simpler unconscious processes and so forth. So there's definitely some of that model where the unconscious is something explaining the conscious. But at the same time, there's also a bit of that other model where the unconscious is presented as something that's in conflict with the conscious. So Nietzsche talks a lot about how the unconscious is falsified by the conscious, how the conscious distorts the unconscious and so forth. He even talks about how that can be dangerous in certain ways. So there's this initial puzzle about how we're to understand those sorts of things. I mean, if you just think of the unconscious as stuff that we're not aware of, then it's hard to reconcile some of those claims. I mean, how does the fact that I have mental processes of which I'm unaware entail that anything is falsified? I mean, at best, it might seem like I just have incomplete information about my mental life. So, you know, there are a number of puzzles about how we should understand that model of the unconscious. And one thing that I think is very interesting about Nietzsche that I think helps to, helps us to see what he's getting at is the fact that he associates conscious thinking with language and concepts. So there are passages in the Gay Science as well as elsewhere where Nietzsche says that conscious thinking always occurs in words. And he'll often associate it with concepts as well. So he'll say that words are expressions of concepts and so forth. Sometimes he'll say that conscious thought is conceptual. So I think what that implies is that he's thinking that conscious thought is essentially tied to language or concepts in a way that unconscious thought is not. And I actually read him as trying to explain the conscious-unconscious distinction in those terms. So conscious thought would be thought that's linguistically or conceptually structured, whereas unconscious thought would be thought that's not conceptual, that has some kind of non-conceptual structure.
Yeah, I found this a really interesting part of that chapter, because usually we think of conscious versus unconscious mind in the way that you say, that is that the conscious mind is the thing that's we represent to ourselves in the mirror of our mind, as it were. But Nietzsche seems to have a different view. As you know, I work on the early period stuff. So I think about his essay, The Truth and Lies in Extramoral Sense. And he even seems to have something of this sort of view, although he doesn't cash it out in terms of conscious versus unconscious. But in Truth and Lies, he has a sort of primitive view where he talks in quasi-Kantian terms about the intuition we receive from the world that's then aesthetically organized by individuals, but then is made into these general conceptual terms that are then communicable to one another, that at the same time falsify them in the way that you say. Is that the same view, or does Nietzsche change from Truth and Lie up to Gay Science on that?
So I think he's trying to preserve a core idea there, but the way in which he's understanding it changes a bit over time. So I think, as you were saying, in Truth and Lie, something very similar is present, but I think he's most of the time anyway, trying to focus on the way in which experience somehow distorts whatever's independent of experience, right? So I have some sort of experience of the world, and that's a distortion of the world. But as I read him, at least, he begins to be a bit skeptical about what that would mean, what it would mean to talk about the world as it's given independently of experience. And as a result, I see him as adopting a similar model, but instead of thinking of conscious thinking as falsifying the world, he's thinking of conscious thinking as falsifying or distorting unconscious thinking.
Yeah, that's useful. This is what I was thinking is the next question, which is the role of the thing in itself, in your view, because, you know, famously, so Maud Marie Clark has wrote a book on Nietzsche and Truth and Philosophy, arguing that Nietzsche changes views about the thing in itself. Mm-hmm. So, okay, so that's helpful. So the idea is that Nietzsche once had a view about the thing in itself, that conscious mind distorts the world, but then he ultimately changes to think that the conscious mind distorts the unconscious mind. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's how I read him anyway. I think there's some historical precedent for that. So when Schopenhauer is reading Kant, he makes a point about how consciousness and conceptualization should be understood. And Schopenhauer is thinking that one problem with Kant is the identification of conceptualized thinking with the whole of thinking. Schopenhauer wants to say that there are certain forms of conscious life that don't involve conceptualization. And I think that for Schopenhauer, that involves things like the representations that animals have, non-human animals have when they're interacting with the world and so forth, as well as some human mental states. But I think Nietzsche is picking up on those sorts of threads and realizing that there's a way of understanding thought that makes a certain type of thought conceptually articulated and then allows another type of thought not to be conceptually articulated. And then that enables him to reject, or at least to avoid talking about Kantian noumena, or, you know, things as they are independently of experience. It enables him to talk instead about two forms of experience, one of which distorts the other.
So does that make him a kind of idealist?
I don't think so, because I think he still thinks that these forms of thought are directed at the world. So they're responsive to something. It's just that, I guess one way of thinking about it is that we have two modes of access to that world. So we're unconsciously responsive to the world, and we're also consciously responsive to it. And those two ways of being responsive to the world present the world to us in different ways. So when we compare the unconscious to the conscious, we'll find that the conscious is somehow superficial or generalized, that in virtue of pressing unconscious thought into a conceptual form, it simplifies it. It structures it in accordance with our language and concepts in a way that can differ from the way in which it's presented unconsciously.
Right, because he never says that the unconscious mind distorts the world, right? I mean, since it's not conceptual in nature, it's hard to imagine how you would assess the kinds of claims that the unconscious mind makes, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, in order to do that, in order to say that the unconscious falsifies the world, you'd have to have, I think, some kind of grip on the world that wasn't provided either by the conscious or the unconscious. And that's the sort of thing that Nietzsche's going to be worried about. But if you have these two types of awareness, conscious and unconscious, you can, at least in principle, think about how they interact with one another and whether one might be a superficial version of the other and so forth.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. So let's shift to the chapter 4 when you start to talk about drives.
Okay.
The German is Triebe. So drives are all over the place, as you say, in Nietzsche's corpus. And I think you say one place there, Nietzsche mentions about 100 different types of drives. Is that right?
Yeah, I tried to count them once and I sort of gave up after 100. I mean, it's kind of hard because he'll sometimes refer to ones that sound very similar to one another. So it's the principle of individuation is a little unclear. But I think if you count in reasonable ways, there are at least 100 and probably quite a few more that he talks about.
Okay, okay. So, and the drives are extraordinarily important in Nietzsche's thought, as you say. They're really, in a way, foundational or fundamental to our mental life. And Nietzsche has a kind of unusual view about these, that the drives seem to have agency in a way. They do things. They strive. They evaluate. They adopt perspectives. And so the question is how to make sense of what a drive is on Nietzsche's view. And so some scholars have been led to think that drives are homunculi. They're little agents battling about in our heads. This is defended by Clark and Dudrick. You rightly, I think, challenge this view. And other scholars reduce drives to just stable affect or desire, right? So they give up the metaphysical side of the homunculi view. But by reducing them in this way, it doesn't capture the agent-like character of drive. So your view is in some ways sort of between those two views. What is it? What's a drive for Nietzsche?
So the way you're characterizing it, I think, is perfectly right, that I think it's something in between those two ways of two ways in which it's commonly understood. So I think that a drive is a certain kind of dispositional state. So the easiest way to think about them is to contrast them with desires, I think. So a standard desire would just have one object. So I might desire to have a drink of water. I might desire to take a walk, something like that. What it will mean to say that I have one of those desires is that I'm disposed to strive to attain that object under certain circumstances. So I think drives are different from desires in two ways. One way is that instead of just having an object, they also have something that I like to call an aim. So this isn't really Nietzsche's terminology. I'm adopting this from Freud, actually, who talks about both the aim and the object of drives. But I think the idea is present in Nietzsche as well. So what it means to say that a drive has both an aim and an object is that Nietzsche sees the drive as aiming at the expression of some characteristic type of activity. So, for example, the sex drive aims at sexual activity, the aggressive drive aims at aggressive activity, the social drive aims at social activity, and so forth. Now, in order to manifest those forms of activity, the drive, of course, has to be directed at something more specific. And the more specific thing that the drive is directed at is what I call the object, using this terminology from Freud. So the aggressive drive just motivates me to express aggressive activity, but I have to pick someone or something to manifest that aggressive activity on. So, you know, if I'm driving, maybe I'll drive angrily, or if I'm, you know, interacting with somebody, maybe I'll yell at them or whatever. That's going to be the object of the drive. And I think Nietzsche's core point, one of his core points anyway, about drives, is that what they seek is just the expression of their aim. And the object is accidental in a way. So what the sex drive seeks is the expression of sexual activity. What the aggressive drive seeks is the expression of aggressive activity. And the drives, you know, to anthropomorphize a bit, they don't care so much about what they're being directed toward, what their objects are, just so long as they're expressed, just so long as there is some sexual activity, some aggressive activity, and so on. So one way in which drives differ from desires is that they have both an aim and an object, where the aim is the characteristic form of activity, and the object is just some chance occasion for expression, and what the drive is really seeking is just the expression of that activity. So that's one thing. And then the other core feature is that Nietzsche tends to associate drives with a kind of perpetual activity. So if you think about standard desires, like a desire for water or a desire to take a walk or something like that, usually those desires go away once they're satisfied. So, you know, I'm thirsty, I drink something, and then I no longer desire to drink. Nietzsche thinks that drives don't have that sort of structure. He thinks that when you fulfill a drive by attaining or interacting with its object, what you typically do is not put the drive to rest, but spur the drive to further activity. So once you start fulfilling the aggressive drive, once you start acting so as to attain aggressive activity, or to express aggressive activity, I should say, you're typically motivated to express even more aggressive activity. So, you know, you're aggressive to one person and it leads in a familiar way to further aggression. So, and analogous points could be made about the other things that Nietzsche calls drives. So unlike desires, which tend to disappear once you fulfill their objects, Nietzsche thinks that drives are actually heightened, at least in standard cases, by the attainment of their objects. So just to tie that all back together, so a drive would be a disposition that has a two-part complement. So it has both an aim and an object, where the aim is the characteristic form of activity, and the object is just some chance occasion for expression. And in addition, when the drive is active, what it motivates you to do is just continue expressing the activity rather than to attain any definite state of affairs that would make the activity cease. So I think that's at root what he means by drives.
Yeah, I found this a really compelling account. And it's also interesting, just to begin, you know, how much Nietzsche owes to Schopenhauer in a certain way. I mean, we already knew this, right? That Nietzsche read Schopenhauer, and, you know, Birth of Tragedy is filled with Schopenhauerese. But both the ways that you described a few minutes ago about the unconscious, and here with the idea of the drive as a sort of perpetually striving thing that works through us and shapes our behavior. I mean, it's very reminiscent of Schopenhauer's view of the will.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think he's adopting it from Schopenhauer, essentially. So what Schopenhauer says about the will to live is that can be fit very naturally into this picture of Nietzschean drives.
Yeah, so I was wondering about how drives are shaped by society. Mm-hmm. So both in their aim and in their object. So in the object, I think I can understand a little bit better, right? So if you have an aggressive drive, this will take different forms depending on the society in which you live, right? So, you know, in some societies, it may come out in war, but in other societies, it may come out in workplace competition or something like that, right? Yeah. I'm particularly wondering about the ferocity or intensity of the drive, or, you know, how much can society and the socialization into society and the development of a second nature, you know, increase or decrease the intensity of drives or give them a different shape or end? Right. Do you understand what I'm asking? I mean, it's one way in which, you know, to push too far in the direction of Schopenhauer, I think, ends up, because Schopenhauer famously, I think, doesn't really attend as well as, say, people like Hegel to the historicity of human nature. And so this is one thing that you do stress on Nietzsche. So maybe you could just draw that out with drives, how drives interact with society in that way.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Nietzsche definitely thinks that they do get altered by social conditions. So there are some passages. There's some interesting ones in Daybreak, especially, but really throughout his works, there's stuff like this, where he'll talk about the way in which the same drive gets expressed very differently in antiquity as opposed to today. So part of what's going to happen, I think, is that a society will have certain expectations for, you know, what appropriate forms of behavior are, or what it is to express aggressive activity. They'll have certain understandings of when it's appropriate to do so, what counts as an expression of aggressive activity, you know, what counts as an expression of sexual activity, things like that. So in those sorts of ways, the societies can influence the expression of the drive. But I think Nietzsche also thinks that in gradual ways, across several generations, drives can be transformed in very fundamental ways. So there's a passage in Daybreak, Daybreak 38, where he talks about this. He talks about the way in which, while I wouldn't be able to just, you know, decide that I'm going to express my aggressive drive in a completely different manner and then have that happen, if you think about the long course of human history, it does seem like over generations, drives do come to get expressed in fundamentally different ways over time. So he thinks that drives are to some extent fixed. So they're fixed in the sense that I can't personally do very much to alter my drives in the course of my lifetime. I can make perhaps minor modifications in them and so forth, but I'm not going to be able to affect a fundamental transformation of them. But at the same time, he wants to say, I think, that over the course of human history, over generations, you can actually redirect certain drives in certain ways. I guess even there, it seems like he's going to want there to be limits, because if you think about texts like the Genealogy of Morality and other texts where Nietzsche discusses the differences between antiquity and modernity, it seems like part of what's going on, just to take the genealogy, for example, part of what's going on with the transition from antiquity to the Judeo-Christian moral system is that certain drives are being reinterpreted. They're being understood as sinful or evil or reprehensible, whereas in antiquity, they were seen as either perfectly fine or even exemplary. And one thing that Nietzsche wants to emphasize is that although that will, those sorts of reinterpretations will affect the way in which the drives are expressed, and maybe even alter their aims to some extent, there's going to be some kernel that's not reached by that. So it's not as if just by deciding that I don't want to have some drive, or just by society deciding that we don't want to have some drive over the course of generations, that drive might still be fixed in us. It might just come out in new ways that aren't fully controllable. So if you think about the aggressive drive, the sexual drive, things like that, it looks like even societies that, at least judging by their surface behavior, have tried to mitigate those drives or redirect those drives in certain ways, that they've been unsuccessful to some extent, that they haven't been able to do that.
Yeah, it seems crucial for the genealogy, right, to have the turn inward of the bad conscience that deepens the soul of man, as it were, right? I mean, so that seems right, that these drives are continue to be present and pushed inward. You know, at the same time, Nietzsche has a view about, say, famously in Zarathustra, about the last man. I mean, the last man seems to have no drives at all, right? So there's a way in which, you know, some of these drives can be extirpated. So is your picture, I mean, I'm wondering about the picture here about drive. Is the picture that we have a bunch of different independent drives and they sort of compete with one another? Or is it that there's a kind of hierarchy of drives? There's a sort of basic drive. Sometimes Nietzsche talks about the will to power, or in terms of this, that then become manifest in different kinds of drives, right? So, or in different ways. So is it kind of independent, you know, multiple different independent vectors of drives, as you say, the vector model, or is it sort of more basic one that manifests in different ways?
So I think it's the former. I think it's a bunch of different vectors that, you know, can be related to each other in certain ways. But I don't think that Nietzsche has a picture where there's one or, you know, some set of basic drives that then get transformed into more differentiated drives. So I think a lot of 19th century philosophers do have pictures like that. A lot of the people Nietzsche was reading, like, you know, Schiller thinks that there are three basic drives, and I think Fichte has like five drives. But I think one thing that's striking about Nietzsche, we mentioned a little while ago that he has something like 100 or so independent drives. One thing that's striking is he doesn't really ever seem to give, at least that I'm aware of, a systematic characterization or list of what those drives are, or to say much about their particular relationships to one another. I think he's not especially interested in trying to provide a kind of hierarchy of drives or an organized system of drives. He thinks there are lots of them that interact with one another in different ways and in different cultures and in different individuals. And he's skeptical, I think, of any attempt to systematize them. With respect to will to power, though, I mean, if you were looking for one thing that might look like a fundamental drive, I think that would be it. But I guess I read will to power a bit differently. I think what he's doing with these claims about will to power is actually just describing the structure of all drives. So rather than will to power being a specific drive, I think will to power is a description of the form that drives take. So this is because I read will to power in roughly the way that Bernard Regenster used to read it. His views actually changed. But I view will to power as aiming at encountering and overcoming challenges or resistances or obstacles. And I think if you think about what drives are, and think back to those points I was making about the way in which drives are never satisfied by the attainment of objects, but always press you to, you know, continue seeking more objects, to continue expressing their form of activity. What that's going to entail, I think, is that drives are these things that press you to continuously overcome challenges and obstacles and so forth. And that what will to power is describing then is basically just what it is to be motivated by drives. So I view will to power as this sort of structural claim about what human action is like, namely that it's motivated by drives rather than will to power being this independent drive.
Yeah, that's helpful here. That view comes up a little bit later in your discussion of freedom, which is good. So, one more thing about drives. I mean, so it's a bunch of independent drives. One may ask the question then, where do you get the list of drives from? That is, how do you determine what counts as a drive and what isn't? What's, you know, sort of an affect that is a manifestation of a drive? How does he distinguish between them? Does he have any standards for it? I mean, I'm sure, not that I know of, Nietzsche has any sort of standards for these things, but I suppose if you want to sort of develop Nietzsche in the direction of a kind of empirical psychology, you know, I would wonder how that kind of move would work.
Yeah. So I think that what's going to count as a drive for him is just any stable dispositional tendency that has the kind of structure I was describing earlier, where it has this aim-object distinction, motivating you to perpetually engage in the activity, and also where the activity isn't satisfied or isn't completed by the attainment of objects. So he's just going to look for motivational states that have that structure. And the way he's going to do that often is by looking at historical phenomena, as he does in the genealogy. Sometimes he'll engage in sort of individual psychologies of particular agents and try to locate drives that way and so forth. So he has this sort of scattershot method, I guess, where sometimes he's doing genealogy, sometimes looking at personal psychology, things like this. But what's guiding all of it when he's talking about drives, I think, is just the idea that what qualifies as a drive is whatever motivational states have that sort of structure that I was just describing. And it's In relation to affects, I think he thinks of affects as things that are generated by drives. So one way in which a drive is going to motivate an agent to act is by generating some kind of affectively charged perception of the environment. So, you know, if I'm motivated by the aggressive drive, Nietzsche's picture is that I sort of see the world differently and experience different emotions than I would if in similar circumstances I were motivated by the social drive or the sexual drive or something like that. So the affects, I think, are these things that are generated by the drives. At least some of the affects are. It's not clear whether he thinks that, you know, each affect will be tied to some drive or whether there can be independent affects. But at least some of the affects will be generated by drives and will help to explain why the agent is motivated to act in the way that the drive seeks.
Yeah, so the next chapter, I think, really shows why analyzing drives in the way that you do really pays off, because you talk about Nietzsche's view of values, which is some ways a confusing element of Nietzsche, but the way you read it is really interesting, so that drives are connected causally with values. That is, that drives give rise to certain thoughts about justification. I think that's your term. So, so drives give rise to certain kinds of affects and certain kinds of desires in different circumstances for certain aims. But there's also a kind of post hoc rationalization about those actions that drives give rise to. Is that right? So maybe expand on that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess the goal of that chapter is, as you're saying, just to look at what values are for Nietzsche, because he talks about values all the time, but he's rarely explicit about what it is to have a value. And when he does make remarks about what it is to have a value, it often looks very mysterious, because he'll often draw these tight connections between having a value and having a drive. But it doesn't, I guess the most natural supposition would be that he just identifies the two, that, you know, having a drive toward X means having a value of X. But if you start thinking about how that would work, I think that picture doesn't quite work. There are lots of cases in which we'd want to say that a person is driven, you know, has a drive toward something without valuing that thing. And that's actually not just a point about, you know, the way in which 21st century English speakers are inclined to describe these things. I mean, Nietzsche himself draws those sorts of distinctions too. Like in the genealogy, there are plenty of cases where he talks about people being motivated by drives toward something that they disvalue, right? So it seems like while Nietzsche wants to draw this tight connection between having a drive and having a value, he doesn't want to identify the two. Mm-hmm. So then that raises this question about what the connection is going to be. And part of what's involved in valuing, as most people understand it anyway, is something about justification. So we tend to think that one thing that distinguishes values from just desires is that values have something to do with a kind of thought about justification. So typically when I value something, I regard it as something that's potentially justifiable or something that relates to warrant in a certain way. So I try to put this together and think about what Nietzsche might be doing, what he might be identifying values with. And I guess what I end up with, in part by considering some other views in the literature, is the idea that for Nietzsche, to value something is to have a drive toward that thing and to have a certain relation to that motivation upon reflection. So basically, if you value something, you have a drive-induced affective orientation toward that thing. So you're positively disposed toward that thing. And in addition, you don't disapprove upon reflection of that affective orientation. Mm. So what that means to, I guess, a concrete case is easiest. So if I value something for Nietzsche, it's going to look like this. So say I value aggressive activity, or say I value something simpler, like I value philosophy. What that's going to mean is that some drive is motivating a positive affective orientation toward philosophy. And then if I step back and reflect on that, if I think about it, I won't disapprove of that. Whereas cases in which drives and values come apart would be cases in which there is, upon reflection, a kind of disapproval of the object of the drive. So I was alluding to some stuff in the genealogy where Nietzsche talks that way. If you think about the scientists in the third part of the genealogy who Nietzsche discusses, these are people who he describes as driven by ascetic tendencies. So they have some drive or set of drives, which is expressing itself in terms of affective orientations directing them toward the ascetic ideal. But many of them, as Nietzsche presents them, have never given that any thought. They've never thought about asceticism. And if they were to think about it, some of them might be inclined to reject it. So in cases where that sort of thing is true, where upon reflection they'd reject the tendencies of their drives, that would be a case in which we distinguish between what the person values and what they're driven toward.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I'm wondering why drives manifest themselves, particularly in justification, I think is the interesting bit. Because, I mean, on one side you say, okay, sure, so upon reflection, we may approve of our drive, but that may not be manifested in the form of justification. It could just be a kind of subjective emotivist account, right? That we say yay or boo to our drives on reflection. That doesn't get us to the claim that values are good, right? That you need a sort of objectivist account where values are good and that they require some kind of normative justification. I mean, I'm with you. I think Nietzsche does look for the justificatory. He thinks that justification is important for value. So I'm just wondering where, you know, what that step is from drive to justification in particular.
Well, I mentioned earlier that I see drives for Nietzsche as manifesting themselves in part by generating these affects. So, you know, the sex drive, if you're in the grip of the sex drive, you're going to perceive, you know, certain people differently than you would if you weren't in the group of it. So you're going to have certain emotions and desires and so forth that you wouldn't otherwise. And, you know, analogously with other drives, the aggressive drive, intellectual drive, and so forth. So one thing that drives are going to do is generate all these affects or these emotions that alter the way in which you perceive the world. So things are going to look alluring or threatening or attractive or aversive, in part depending on the types of drives that you have or which drives are active. So that, I think, is going to be the typical way that drives operate. So we're, you know, we are very rarely completely explicit and reflective in our deliberations. We sometimes engage in these moments of self-conscious reflection about what to do and so forth. But, you know, for the most part, on a day-to-day basis, I just sort of, I don't think very much. You know, I just get up in the morning, walk to my office, see various things, do various things. I'm not attending and deliberating at each moment to, you know, the thoughts going through my head. So I think that Nietzsche thinks that most of the time we're driven by the affects that we're experiencing and so forth. But we can also step back and reflect on those things. So if I'm, for whatever reason, troubled by or just curious about what I'm doing, or if I'm just in a situation where I want to think more clearly about how I feel about something or why I'm responding in a certain way to something, I can then step back and sort of think about what I'm experiencing, what emotions I'm experiencing, and so forth. I can even, if I'm sort of hyper-reflective, I can try to step back from my emotional perception of a state. So imagine you're in a heated argument with somebody and you're sort of carried away by like the rhetoric and the passions and so forth. But I think there's this familiar process where you can sometimes manage to sort of stand back from that for a little bit, and you can sort of see that you're responding in a way that you wouldn't if you didn't have these emotions, these affects. So you can at least get this sense that your perception of the situation is being altered or influenced by these emotions that you're experiencing. And it's at moments like that when you can start thinking about whether those responses are warranted and so forth. So I don't think that Nietzsche thinks it happens all that often. I think he thinks it mostly happens retrospectively when we think about past instances of behavior. So in the genealogy, for example, Nietzsche doesn't really care whether I've, up till I read that book, noticed ascetic tendencies in my behavior or whatever. What he cares about is whether, having read the book, I can then sort of look back and see that, okay, in all these past circumstances, I was motivated by these affects that, or these drives even, that upon reflection I disavow. So in that retrospective fashion, I can think about the justification of these responses. And, you know, there's this further question about what I do then. So I start worrying about whether these things are justified. And then there's this question about what it would even be for one of those responses to be justified or for it to be unjustified. So that brings in this stuff about what the standards of evaluation are going to be. And there is when I, reading Nietzsche, would start talking about will to power. But that's sort of another story.
Yeah. And we'll get to more of the normative.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an interesting thing about Nietzsche's moral psychology, that, you know, Nietzsche's can give a descriptive account of the emergence of values and how human beings use values, but not himself commit himself to a kind of normative account of these things.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking about this, the drives to justification and that reflect. I wonder if you can connect it up with your own account of the conscious mind and the conceptual nature of the conscious mind, that reflection itself brings with it a conscious conceptualization, which itself lends itself to justification, right? Insofar as justification is conceptual and normative, so that it can't, you know, reflection and justification can't simply be emotivists, that just related to my own personal relationship to my own drives, but that whenever we engage in reflection, it's already communal in that sense, because we're already ensconced within language.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think I agree with that. And I think that's also just mirrored by the way that Nietzsche writes. I mean, he uses a lot of impassioned rhetoric when he's attacking philosophers or moralities or values that he disagrees with. But it's not as if he stops there. There's it's not just a question of how he feels. There's also some arguments that back it up and some thoughts about whether various values or philosophies and so forth are justified.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, it's useful because I've been thinking for a while about justification and Nietzsche, especially against the the Leiter, Brian Leiter, you know, has argued that when Nietzsche talks about justification, he's not talking about normative justification. It's more of a rhetorical or emotional sort of appeal. And I don't think that's right when it comes to him.
Yeah. I think it's very hard to maintain that position while reading Nietzsche's text. I mean, it's very hard to make sense of what Nietzsche would take himself to be doing if that were actually his philosophical view. So, why would he write these books that are so deeply critical of other people's emotive reactions to various phenomena if what Nietzsche himself is doing is nothing more than expressing some unjustifiable emotional responses that he happens to have?
Right. I think Leiter thinks of it as he's trying to rhetorically move us to us emotionally to a certain view. But then one might ask, why listen to Nietzsche at all then? If it's just a matter of, a kind of propaganda, or emotional appeal, why even read the book?
Yeah. It's also puzzling why there would be all this emphasis on self-knowledge and genealogy and so forth. If ultimately what underwrites everything is just these irrational emotional responses, it's hard to see what the point of Nietzsche's books would be from Nietzsche's own perspective, if that were his philosophical view, I think.
I wanted to ask you about another scholar. You take up Sebastian Gardner's objection at the end of this chapter on value. His view goes something like this, that if we think of value, it's a kind of challenge to your view, that if we think of values and justification as essentially kinds of illusions that are caused by our drives, we then lose a bit of our attachment to those values. That is, if we live in the modern age where we've developed what he calls a taste for justification, and it turns out that we find out that these justifications are just illusions from our basic biological drives, it's a kind of debunking move that's familiar in contemporary psychology. But you argue against this, saying this can't be right because we continue to believe in illusions. Anyway, use the example of the cafe wall illusion, but there are other visual illusions perceptual apparatus. Not even though we know it's an illusion, we continue to believe in it. I wonder about, maybe in response, what Gardner would say to this. Maybe he goes too far in saying that it's inconceivable that we could affirm our values while also seeing them as caused by drives. And maybe it would weaken the claim a bit, because I'm just thinking about how Nietzsche thinks about the turn towards modernity and the way that it tends to attenuate our commitment to values in certain ways, that the ancients for Nietzsche seem to be much more committed in certain ways, loyal. Again, I'm thinking of the Untimely Meditations and the transition to modernity and the way in which, religions and the old moral orders tend to be to break down, and we're left with more egoism all around. So I'm just wondering what you think about that, is it the case on Nietzsche's view? You think that this, the development of modernity and the development of the taste for justification may lead to a kind of problem. I don't think it's a problem with your view. It seems like it's Nietzsche's identifying a kind of tension in modern culture that if we pay too much attention to this drive for truth and the drive for justification, that could come at the expense of our drives, our life, right? Is that, what do you think of that?
Yeah. So I think that is a problem for Nietzsche. So I guess I'll say two things about that. So, one thing is that when Nietzsche's worried about nihilism and the last man and things like that, I think that he is worried about the phenomena that you're articulating. He's worried that a certain kind of justification for our values is no longer available or no longer seems to be available. And one potential result of that is a kind of weakening of our commitment to any values whatsoever. So I think that's a big problem, and I think he's deeply worried about that. I've started to try to write some stuff about that actually recently, since writing this book. So I think that there are some very interesting issues that arise in trying to account for Nietzsche on those points. But, as it relates to the Gardner point, So I think Sebastian Gardner, in this very interesting article, he raises, as you said, this question about whether it's incoherent, as he puts it, but maybe you could just ask if it's stable or possible or something, whether a person can actually value something while thinking of that value as unjustified. So as I was just saying, I think there can be a kind of weakening of commitment to the value, but I think it's entirely possible and even quite common for people to value things without thinking that they're justifiable or without thinking that they have any way of justifying them. So I think that Nietzsche uses a lot of these perceptual metaphors and intends them quite seriously. That's part of why I think that the analogy with perceptual illusions is helpful. So it's this familiar fact that I can know that some perceptual illusion, you know, the stick that's bent in water or the cafe wall illusion or whatever, I can know that it's an illusion, but I keep experiencing it in the same way. The knowledge that it's an illusion doesn't affect my perception. And I think that Nietzsche thinks that something quite similar can happen with values. So I can realize that, I don't know, suppose I adopt some or come to believe in some evolutionary argument about the sex drive, disposing me to love someone merely because I want to reproduce and all this. I can think that that's true without it affecting my love for that person at all. You know, I can think that that love is in some way unjustified or has this problematic explanation without that dislodging the love. And I just think that's a very common phenomenon. I try to give some other examples of it in the book, but I think that, so Gardner raises an objection, raises this as an objection to Nietzsche's account of value. And what I want to say, I guess, is that if you take that sort of perceptual metaphor seriously, and if you think of values in terms of, you know, not the things that people say to themselves about what they value, not the having of thoughts like, you know, I value X, but instead think about values as these things that are identified with the affective dispositions generated by drives plus attendant thoughts about justification, then they're very difficult to dislodge. And I can have all kinds of thoughts about how I wish I didn't value something. I wish I didn't have a certain kind of pattern of affects towards something, or just that I think that I don't have any justification for doing that. And yet I can still continue to have that kind of orientation toward the thing. So I think that Nietzsche can say that he can say both of the following things. He can say that, in many cases, reflection upon a value doesn't dislodge the value, even when the reflection results in the thought that the value is unjustified. So we can say that. But then it relates in this interesting way to that other point that you were mentioning and that I talked about a minute ago at the beginning, where he also worries that with the sort of widespread acceptance of these thoughts about lack of justification and so forth, we might get into this problematic situation where our commitment to various values is attenuated. And I can say more about that if you want.
Yeah. I'm interested. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess,
you're working on this in an article now or?
Yeah. I have this article. It's called, Fugitive Pleasure and the Meaningful Life. And it came out like a year ago in the Journal of the American Philosophical Association, but I also, I'm trying to write some other stuff about it. It's at early stages now. But anyway, the basic idea, I think, is that so Nietzsche sometimes talks about not just values, but also what he'll call highest values. And I think there's this question about what he means when he says something is a highest value as opposed to just being, you know, like an ordinary value. So when he gives examples of the things he calls highest values, they tend to be these things that look like these overriding ideals. So he'll mention things like compassion for Schopenhauer, happiness for the utilitarian, thoughts about justice and in certain ethical traditions. So they seem to be these things that are central to certain kinds of ethical viewpoints. And he sometimes associates nihilism with the loss of highest values. So there's some interesting passages where he identifies one kind of nihilism with the loss of highest values, as opposed to the loss of just all values. So I think the stuff about the last men too, I think one thing that's striking about them is that they're presented as people who don't have any understanding of highest values. They don't have any sort of overriding values of that sort. So there's this question, I think, about why Nietzsche thinks that modernity is at risk for the loss of highest values. And I think it has something to do with justification. So the easiest way to have one of these things he's calling a highest value is to be completely convinced of the truth of some religion or ethical system that says that there is one of these things, and that's the highest value. But if you're dubious about that, I think what he worries about is that you might begin to lose highest values and merely have ordinary values. So you might still value compassion or justice or whatever, but you might not treat it as this thing that's absolutely central to your life, that's overriding, that has this supreme importance. You might treat it as something that, given that it can't be, to your mind, fully justified, is sort of on par with alternatives to it. So I no longer value it as stringently. I'm no longer as deeply committed to it. So the commitment to the value might be attenuated when the person begins to reflect on the way in which he lacks a justification for it. But although the commitment's attenuated, the person still values it. So he still values, you know, compassion or justice or whatever. It's just that he doesn't value it in quite the same way. And I think that is part of what Nietzsche's trying to get at when he talks about nihilism and The Last Man and so forth. It's a slackening of commitment to values. You still have values, but you don't have them in quite the same way that we used to.
Yeah, that seems very right to me. Yeah. So let's shift to some of these kinds of issues come up in the normative side of your discussion. In chapters 8 and 9, you talk about the development of the self as a kind of achievement in Nietzsche's view and Nietzsche's view of freedom, which are just really excellent chapters. I'm so glad that you talk about these issues because I think they're so central to Nietzsche's own view, especially the Nietzsche's view of freedom, which is for so long been overlooked in Nietzsche scholarship and has sort of started to get its due. So, but first in chapter 8, you talk about the social context or conditions for selfhood. And you talk about how someone is a self when they bear an appropriate relation to their culture. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so Nietzsche says things like this a lot. So he'll talk about most individuals lacking a genuine self. We find passages like that in many of his books. And when he gives examples of individuals who definitely do have selves, so when he gives examples of great individuals, people like Napoleon and Goethe and so forth, those tend to be his examples. One thing that's interesting about them is that they have a lot of differences. So Goethe and Napoleon are quite different from one another in a number of respects. They perform very different actions. They have different sorts of values and so forth. But one thing that seems to be shared by all of Nietzsche's examples of great individuals who have genuine selves is that they in some way free themselves from some of the evaluative assumptions that are present in their cultures. So Nietzsche sees Napoleon, for example, as hearkening back to Renaissance ideals as well as certain kinds of classical ideals in a way that is not present in other individuals in his culture. Beethoven, another example of one of Nietzsche's great individuals, he praises him for being a key figure in the shift toward romantic values. There are similar remarks about Goethe and so forth. So I think that one thing that's common to a lot of these individuals is that they break free of some of the central values of their cultures and they begin to institute some new set of values. That's the central thing that Nietzsche focuses upon for each of these great individuals. And, you know, Nietzsche sometimes says that about himself as well, that he is this sort of new revaluation of values, that he hopes to instigate a new revaluation of values in his culture. So I think that basically what Nietzsche's thinking about when he thinks about unified selves and genuine selves rather, and their relations to their culture, is that a person's going to qualify as a genuine self for him to the extent that she revalues her values, to the extent that she steps back from the evaluative assumptions that are prevalent in her culture and bears some new relation to values.
Yeah, that's good. And it's sort of, I've thought for a while about the great or exemplary individual in Nietzsche. And, you know, it seems like the familiar view about them is that they stand towards culture, you know, their own culture, you know, like we might stand towards a chalkboard, right? So, you know, you just erase everything that's on the chalkboard and you scrawl some new values on it. I wonder about that kind of account, though. I've thought in terms of that Nietzsche has kind of two different concepts of the way that selves stand, or, you know, genuine selves stand towards their culture, which is one, a kind of expressive view, you could say, that is that, you know, that great individuals unify a fragmented culture, that culture is problematic and that there's some kind of transcendence that's needed, but the transcendence is a kind of expression about what's deeper, more fundamental. So, I mean, I think of, you know, say, for instance, Napoleon, you brought up Napoleon. You know, you might think of Napoleon, okay, so he harkens back to Renaissance, but that is an expression of a modern tendency of value, right? So it's one in which we've fallen off from the modern, some kind of modern cultural tendency, and Napoleon's helping us retrieve something and expressing something in a higher way, right? I mean, so that's one way to think about it. I mean, another way is, you know, sort of reminiscent of Hegel and Hegel's view of the world historical individual, that as the world historical individual sort of comes along at a particular point in the culture where the culture is undergoing a kind of self-contradiction, an inner sort of self-contradiction, and the great individual sublates the contradiction and ushers in a new age. I've said that Nietzsche just holds both of these different kinds of views, and that he sort of moves between those. I don't know if either of those kind of resonate with your approach, or neither of them.
I think they do, because, I mean, I think one thing that's interesting about all of those individuals that Nietzsche uses as paradigms of great individuals is that they all succeed to some extent in shifting culture in various ways. So, you know, if you think about some of the people who had the most influence on culture, or at least on values, you might come up with something like Nietzsche's list, right? So Goethe is enormously influential for a period. Napoleon, of course, Beethoven in a, I guess, more restricted way. So all of them are people who have these monumental impacts on culture, or at least on certain parts of culture. And moreover, there are people who have, Nietzsche thinks, a kind of life-affirmative attitude, or who promote values that lead people to have a life-affirmative attitude. So, you know, there are other people who have these profound cultural impacts, more profound, really, than the individuals who Nietzsche mentions, but who he doesn't present as great individuals. So, like, St. Paul is a clear example. I mean, he arguably has a much larger impact on culture than any of these other people who Nietzsche talks about, but he's not labeled a great individual, presumably because he's promoting a kind of value that Nietzsche thinks is responsible for a negation rather than an affirmation of life, or when it has these damaging tendencies and so forth. So, I mean, I guess relating that to what you were saying about the way in which the great individual might sort of bring together these fragmentary elements of culture and so forth. I mean, one thing that's interesting is that a lot of those individuals, Goethe, Napoleon, maybe are the best examples, is that they do at least attempt to reconcile things that are nascent in the cultures, but they're also introducing new ways of doing so, as Nietzsche sees it. So they're not starting from nowhere. I mean, it's not like Goethe would have had an impact of the same sort if he were alive today, or if, you know, he'd lived a few hundred years before he did. He's working with things that are culturally specific, and he's doing things that make sense in that context rather than some other context. So it's not as if he's just starting with a blank slate and then could go anywhere. Analogously with Napoleon and so forth. So I think they're all relating to things that are present in their cultures. But they're relating in such a way that they, meld features of their cultures with new values that affect multitudes of people, and potentially at least result in life-affirming rather than life-negating stances toward life.
Yeah, that's helpful. I one of the ways I like to think about this is in terms of when Nietzsche talks about that these individuals have a certain kind of responsibility for culture. So he'll say this in Beyond Good and Evil, say in section 62 or 63 or thereabouts, he says that, you know, the philosopher is the one who has the most tremendous responsibility for an age. And I sort of connect that in my mind with Nietzsche's repeated discussions about redemption and how the great individuals have a kind of redeeming role for humanity. So in some ways, Nietzsche's playing on the development of Christianity and how, you know, Christianity has introduced this kind of role for individuals into the world, a kind of individual that can take responsibility for humanity as a whole and redeem it, from its sins, as it were. And that's something that, you know, for all of Nietzsche's worries about Christianity and the development of modernity, I mean, this is something new that modernity introduces. In any case, I guess I'm wondering what you think about Nietzsche's view of responsibility for society and culture on the part of these individuals.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you that's something that's very important for him. I mean, I think he especially in modernity, thinks that we're at the cusp of this sort of terrible crisis. So, you know, he thinks that the evaluative systems and the ideals that have sustained us for two millennia are in the process of breaking down, and that there's going to be some kind of transformation in our values that's as dramatic or maybe even more dramatic than the transition between the values of antiquity and the Judeo-Christian ones. So, you know, one direction that we could go is the direction of nihilism, where we just lack any kind of orienting ideal. We lack any sort of set of values that can sustain us, and we're possibly led to a kind of life negation that Nietzsche worries about. And then the other possibility is that the opposite happens, that out of the ruins of the old ideals, something new emerges. And I think that's what Nietzsche's hoping for. I think that's what he himself is trying to spark in some way. If someone can do that, then it would be a tremendous responsibility, right? Because what he's basically envisioning is someone who saves modernity in a certain way, who staves off this process of cultural collapse into nihilism by instituting a new set of values, who redirects generations of human beings towards some new set of values. So that's a tremendous responsibility for anyone who's in a position to potentially impact it. And I think for that reason, when Nietzsche's talking about philosophers in the sense of, you know, he sometimes distinguishes philosophers in the sense of people who just, you know, do scholarly work and so forth from genuine philosophers who are the ones who institute new ideals. When we're talking about that latter type of philosopher, that would be a tremendous responsibility to try to salvage these social systems that Nietzsche sees as collapsing by instituting some new set of ideals.
Yeah, so let's talk about your view of Nietzsche on freedom. So you turn to discuss, you know, from the relationship of the genuine self to society to precise form of self-determination that Nietzsche holds. So Nietzsche's view is that the self is a kind of achievement, and the self, it determines itself in a certain way. And so it's sort of paradoxical. So how do you make sense of that? One way to make sense of it is with a kind of romantic conception, that is that we have a natural kernel within us that's distorted by society and we just have to clear away social conditioning to get down to it. And you rightly argue that Nietzsche, certainly in the mature period, doesn't hold to that view. I'm not sure that he holds to it in the early period either. In the Schopenhauer's Educator, he says that this yourself is not deep within you. It's immeasurably high above you. Yeah. But in any case, Nietzsche also doesn't hold to a Kantian view, that is that the achievement of self-determination as a sort of formal feature of freedom itself, as codified in the categorical imperative. So what's your alternative view? How does Nietzsche develop this understanding of self-determination?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I think that Nietzsche's trying to, in some ways, blend some insights from Kant and some insights from Hegel and other figures. So he wants to articulate some conception of freedom, some sort of positive conception of freedom. And if you look at his remarks, especially in the middle and later works, it looks like he's very often associating freedom with a kind of revaluation. So he's thinking that the free individual, he'll sometimes just say, is the one who's self-determining, who sets his own values. So freedom, I think we can see, is going to have something to do with creating values or reassessing values, at least for Nietzsche. And then there's a question about what that could mean. So as you were saying, like, one picture you could have is a conception of freedom as a kind of authenticity, where there's some kind of true self, where I have some true set of values or true set of desires or drives, and what the free individual would be doing is trying to discover what those are and then wholeheartedly embrace them. I think that Nietzsche doesn't have that picture, that he, you know, he sometimes mocks the idea that you should bear that kind of relation to yourself, where the self is something to be discovered rather than created. So he doesn't have that picture. So the question is, where are the values coming from? He doesn't have the Kantian picture, where Kant thinks that you just sort of reflect on the notion of self-determination itself and somehow get ethical content out of that. Rather, it looks like he has something more like the Hegelian picture in mind, where Hegel thinks that the demand for self-determination requires a kind of reflection upon the ethical life of one society, where you start with what is given. You start with the values that are incorporated into your culture and so forth. For Nietzsche, you start with the drives and the affects generated by them, and you assess those in terms of freedom. But then what's that going to look like for Nietzsche? So, you know, we have this picture where it seems like Nietzsche is inviting us to gather lots of materials that are relevant for self-understanding. So do genealogy, think about your affects, think about your emotions, think about your values. Suppose I do all that, so I, you know, get lots of knowledge about what I value, what my drives are, what my affects are. Where do I go from there? You know, what criterion am I supposed to be using to decide which of those values and dispositions and so forth to try to keep, and which to try to work against, which to struggle against? And I think it's there that Nietzsche introduces this notion of will to power, or relies on this notion of will to power that I mentioned earlier. So what we're supposed to do, as Nietzsche will sometimes say, is we're supposed to assess any given value or drive or disposition in terms of the way in which it comports with will to power. So what's supposed to be problematic about ascetic tendencies, for example, is the way in which they undermine power, or Nietzsche will sometimes say the way in which they undermine life, but then he, I think, associates life with power. He'll say that the fundamental tendency of life is will to power. So we're supposed to gather this extensive information about our values and affects and so forth, and we're supposed to use that information to determine as best we can whether the values conflict with will to power. When they do, we're supposed to struggle against them or strive for some kind of alternative. When they don't, when they seem compatible with will to power, they're perfectly fine. So what I imagine the free individual doing for Nietzsche is basically what Nietzsche's inviting us to do in a lot of his texts, like the genealogy of morality. You sort of step back from your values, your dispositions, your ideals, your habitual tendencies. You think about ways in which they might undermine this conception of will to power. And when they do conflict with it, you find them problematic and you struggle for ways to move on from that. So that's what the free individual would be doing. The free individual would gather all this information, acquire extensive self-knowledge, use that self-knowledge or self-understanding to try to identify what in particular she values, what she desires, what she's driven toward. And then she would assess those things in terms of will to power, rejecting to the extent that she can the things that conflict with power and preserving the things that seem less in conflict with will to power.
Yeah, that's good. And this was all very helpful. And the way that you develop Nietzsche's view of self-determination and in dialectical relation with Kant and Hegel was very interesting. And I have great sympathy with that interpretation. When you get to the will to power, though, I guess the question becomes, for me, So why should we listen to the will to power? Right. Yeah. Why is that the normative standard? There's one way you might think about this is, I mean, if you're a Kantian or Hegelian, you may say, well, all of a sudden you've just introduced an external standard that that you know, vitiates human freedom. You've returned to a kind of pre-critical metaphysics and given up the entire project of grounding normativity on self-determination. So why should we listen to the will to power?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the central question for Nietzsche's ethical theory. So I try to give an answer to that in my first book, Agency and the Foundation of Ethics. But basically, what I see Nietzsche is doing is trying to argue that will to power is inescapable. So the question becomes moot in a certain way. So any particular drive or value or disposition, we can at least in theory detach from. I mean, it might be very hard to do so, but I can at least try to, you know, limit my aggressive tendencies or limit my sex drive or things like this. But I think that Nietzsche, if we accept this view of his, that will to power is just a description of the form that drive motivated activities take, then if we try to envision not acting on will to power, then what we'd be envisioning is just not having drives, essentially. In other words, we'd be imagining that we're a fundamentally different type of creature than we are. So what I try to argue is that Nietzsche's basic argument is that will to power has this kind of normative authority only because it's inescapable. It's something that we can't stand back from, because any attempt to act, any attempt to do anything whatsoever, will just express will to power. So if will to power is inescapable, his thought is that that's enough, given certain assumptions to show that it's normatively authoritative. And that's the way the argument's basically going to go. So I try to argue that in more detail in the book, that will to power is this constitutive feature of agency for Nietzsche. So as long as you accept his arguments about our actions being motivated by drives and drives having this structure that's described by will to power, it'll just be absolutely impossible to do anything that doesn't manifest will to power. So if you try to act against power, you'll just be in this conflicted state. You won't be able to stand back from it. And for him, that's sort of the deepest that these ethical questions can go. So, you know, the question, why try to minimize conflicts with will to power? It's basically answered by the claim that that's all you can do, that will to power is inescapable. You can't get past it.
Yeah. I mean, I think about this, and, you know, you might say, well, okay, if it's inescapable, then why, you know, how do you get a critical purchase on people who, you know, on Nietzsche's view, fail to live up to the will to power, right? If it's inescapable, then we should all be doing everything right.
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah. I mean, one way that I guess I've tried to think about this is in terms of how the will to power can admit of degrees of higher and lower, right? So I agree with you that it seems that the will to power is pervasive, and it's inescapable in that way. And so it serves as necessarily our normative standard, because it sort of animates the very question of normativity itself. But so one way one might say, how do you get a critical purchase, is to think of how will to power can manifest itself in a higher form. And so what do I mean by higher form? Well, you know, Nietzsche will talk about how philosophy is the most spiritual will to power, right? And beyond good and evil. And so Nietzsche seems to think that will to power can, as it were, curve back on itself, right? That there are some entities that can exert power over themselves or exert power over their own wills. And that is itself a kind of higher manifestation of the will to power, and the way that we can develop a kind of critical potential. I mean, I think that this is somewhat implicit in your own view about that, you know, will to power is itself a structural description of how drives themselves always seek to overcome themselves. So I don't know what you think about that as a kind of way to circumvent this objection. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that something like that is probably right. So it's true that if Nietzsche thinks that will to power is pervasive, he needs to think that there are differences in the way that it's expressed or manifest in different people, because he thinks that, you know, some people are good expressions of will to power, or some actions are, and some aren't. So one way of drawing that distinction is by talking about different types of will to power or different forms of it. Another way of doing it is by thinking about will to power as a kind of aim. It's an aim of encountering and overcoming resistance. But of course, you know, the fact that you aim at something doesn't mean that you succeed in it. So another thing you can do is think about the degree to which someone manifests power. So it might be that this won't be the whole difference, but one difference between somebody Nietzsche praises, like Goethe or Napoleon or whoever, and some ordinary guy, is going to be that the former person expresses a much higher degree of will to power than the latter. Another thing that you can do is think about, if you look at the genealogy, for example, and look at the way in which in the first essay, Nietzsche's contrasting the sort of conflicted, self-undermining state of the Judeo-Christian individuals with the freer, less conflicted state of the ancient nobles. It might be that another way of thinking about will to power being manifested differently is by thinking about cases in which it's self-undermining and cases in which it isn't, or cases in which it's somehow in conflict with itself and other cases in which it's not. So I think that all of that's going to be present in Nietzsche. So there are going to be a couple of different ways of saying that although everybody expresses power, you know, although will to power is present in every action and in every person, there are going to be better and worse manifestations of it. You know, some are going to be very weak manifestations, whereas others are strong. Some are going to be conflicted or self-undermining, whereas others aren't going to have those features. In addition, it might be that some are higher and some are lower expressions of power. I think some are more sublimated, so to speak, than others. You know, some incorporate more tendencies, whereas others focus just on isolated aspects of the person. So that might be another relevant difference. So I think there are going to be all kinds of ways of saying that although the aim is present in everyone, it's not going to be realized in the same way in every individual.
Yeah, that's great. Well, Paul, you've been really generous with your time. I really appreciate it. I've had a lot of fun. This has been really, really great to chat about Nietzsche.
Yeah, thanks. I've had a great time. And these are great questions. A lot of fun to talk about these things.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.